From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're wrapping up a series of shows where we've explored the problem of sexual assault on the country's college campuses. Studies show the number of sex crimes on campus is on the rise. By some accounts, up 50% over the last 10 years. It's being called a crisis, an epidemic. We've talked about the cultural issues, the structural ones that play into the problem. Today we're talking about what colleges do after a sexual assault. Some are calling on schools to develop their own justice systems to adjudicate these crimes, to hire consultants, to conduct surveys. So there are lots of questions to talk about today. How do you hold perpetrators accountable? What's the standard of proof? What's the role of faculty? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2011, the Office for Civil Rights in the Department of Education released a letter to the country's colleges and universities. It called on schools to start taking their role more seriously in what seems to be the growing problem of sexual assault on school campuses. The letter said schools need to put consistent and reliable systems in place to deal with these assaults, which meant softening the impact on victims, which meant holding perpetrators accountable, developing tracking systems, conducting surveys, and coming up with programs to stop the assaults in the first place. One observer called it a dawn of a new awakening. Over the past few weeks, we've been talking about this problem. We've talked about the cultural and structural elements on college campuses that contribute to all of this. Today, we're talking more about the issue of responsibility and how schools can deal with all of this after an assault takes place. Sexual assault, of course, is a crime. So should colleges and universities be adjudicating the crime, or should they that all of that be left to the criminal justice system itself? But more generally, what are the best ways to hold everyone more accountable? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We wanted to get some perspective from the president of a university, so we invited David Pershing to join us, president, of course, of the University of Utah. Before taking the helm in 2012, he was on the university's chemical engineering faculty. He was there for 35 years doing that, and Professor Pershing, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you, although this is a somewhat difficult subject to talk about.
I imagine it is. Let me ask you this. I wanted to start on this long list of stuff that you have to worry about, which I imagine is a pretty long list. Where do you put sexual assault?
There's no doubt, Doug, that today sexual assault has to be high on that list. It's very important to all of us. I feel that not only as the 15th president of the university, but also as a father of three daughters. My oldest daughter is actually graduating from medical school at the moment. But my wife and I have two younger daughters that will be looking at college very shortly. We hope they'll come to the U, and we certainly want them to be safe if they do come to the university. But regardless of where they go, we want them to be safe. One of the things we feel very strongly about as parents, and I do feel this with some commitment, is that it's important for parents to make sure their young children have good self-esteem. When they come to college, it helps a lot if they feel positive about themselves.
So I want to talk a little bit more about some of these other aspects here. Let me ask you, I know you're in the process of, and probably always will be, but in the process of trying to figure out what are the elements here that come into play. But I wanted to get your thinking on some of all of this. Some have suggested that there are structures in place, pressures that the schools have to deal with that contribute to the problem. Among them is this concern that there's this attempt by universities to in the attempt to get students, attract them, because they need the tuition money, that they sort of overemphasize the party culture of a school, that they, you know, because they don't want to be a buzzkill, these places, right? And so therefore they don't therefore they don't address one of the contributing factors, or some say is a contributing factor, and that is binge drinking, you know, those kinds of things. Do you think that's part of the problem? I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I think at the University of Utah, we certainly do not sell ourselves as a party school. Obviously, that's not what we're about, and that may be an issue in some other places. I don't really think it's an issue here.
But the question of the structural problems on a campus, party culture in general, whether you emphasize yourselves as a party school or not, I'm sure you worry about, or do you worry about, do you think much about binge drinking, you know, those kinds of things, putting people in vulnerable positions, stuff like that?
Well, that's an excellent point. We do worry about that because that is a key issue. And one of the things that I say to everybody is when you go to a party, any kind of a party, go with a friend. And be very careful that you make sure you leave with that friend. One of the best things you can do is to watch out for each other. Another thing that I say to leaders of various organizations, student organizations, is think about what's happening at your events. Have the members of the organization look out for each other, because none of us want something bad to happen. Certainly the students don't want that, and we don't want that.
Yeah. What is it about a college campus? What is it? Is it about the culture? What is it that seems to be an opening for such rampant sexual violence? What is it about it, do you think? Have you figured that out? Or certainly you've thought about the different elements that come into play.
We have, no doubt about it. And I don't think it's rampant. I don't want to ever give that impression at all. One of the things that's happening is that we are reporting the statistics under new federal guidelines very carefully now. And so the numbers are going to go up. It's inevitable. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't mean more incidents are occurring.
Just more reporting.
More reporting. We're also trying to be very much better about helping students who do report. Another positive thing.
But you... But you have seen the statistics. I know you don't want to suggest that there's a lot of rampant violence going on the campus, maybe at the University of Utah, but you do acknowledge this is a very significant, concerning problem.
This is a significant, concerning problem, to be sure, and one we're trying to work hard on.
So what are the back to that question, though, I was asking, and that is, what are the cultural elements on a campus that you think contributes to that?
Well, we definitely have a lot of single young people that are all together in a fairly confined space. And so there are going to be some incidents. But our goal is to prevent those incidents to the best of our ability, and in particular to take proactive actions. We actually did 22 orientations for our freshmen and transfer students last year to try to talk about this issue. And talking about it is important. It's hard, but it's important. We believe we contacted more than 5,000 students in our orientation and some 800 parents and family members. To try to get people thinking about this, that's one good thing we can do.
You know, one of the things that there's a piece of federal legislation, and one of the things it requires is that school administrators, or it's considering anyway, that they conduct surveys on the scope of the problem. Are you doing that? Have you done that? That is, conducting surveys to say, okay, where does the university fit in the scheme of things in terms of the sexual assault problem?
Right. We certainly have been talking to our students to understand that, and we are trying to use that to help us plan the programs that we are putting in place to try to help prevent these problems.
So conducting surveys,
yes.
is if it's not a part now, you want
it
to be.
Right.
I wonder, it seems as though this is a big question for college campuses, the question of whether or not you adjudicate sexual assault crimes on university campuses, or you leave that to the criminal justice system itself. Because there's some calls, as you know, for the university to take care of this, because the university can lower the burden of proof. It's not as discouraging for victims to come forward, and it can be, frankly, a more attractive place, a more accommodating place for victims to get justice, to, you know, get the perpetrators to take responsibility for the crime. But then the question is the campus the place for that? Do you have the infrastructure? Do you have the people in place to adjudicate all of this? How are you thinking about that? Is, first of all, the campus of the University of Utah, is that a place where these sexual assault crimes should be adjudicated, do you think?
Absolutely. It is a place where no matter what happens with the police, that's a separate process, a separate set of rules. But we now investigate all allegations of discrimination and sexual violence is one of the most egregious kinds of examples that we have, that we do investigate. And this process can result in a variety of different outcomes. We have to, for sure, we have an obligation to conduct these proceedings in a manner that protects everybody's privacy. So there are really strong rules about that. But no, we are definitely investigating, and we are definitely willing to dismiss students if the activity is completely inappropriate.
What happens if a person is convicted? I'll put it that way. That's a term of art and legal term. But let's say somebody is found guilty. What happens to them at the University of Utah?
Well, in our processes, this is a student process run by student affairs with our legal team. And if the perpetrator is found guilty of an egregious act—
Wait. You're saying that that students are adjudicating this?
No. I didn't mean to say
that. Okay.
No, it's run by our legal team, and we have a very strong legal team.
Right.
And ultimately, if the person is found guilty, then they may well be dismissed from the university. Now, that's completely independent of what may happen in the civil procedure, criminal procedure side.
So you'll let that play out in
exactly.
The civil but you have your own procedures in place.
That's right.
As well.
This is one of the things the federal government has been pushing, and we now have that in place and fully running.
I wonder if this is something that you worry about, and that is— what is the role of your faculty in all of this? I mean, you want them to be attending to teaching biology and teaching dance and teaching art and all of those kinds of things. But what is the role of faculty? What are you saying to your faculty members about whatever role they may, if they are playing a role in all of this?
That's an excellent question because I wouldn't limit the answer to just sexual issues like this.
No.
In fact, what we're trying to do is to get the faculty to help us recognize student problems. If a student is having trouble, we now have a referral service in our student affairs office that the faculty can call up and say, I don't know quite what's going on here, but I sense something is not going well with a student. Obviously, another problem we worry a lot about is suicide.
Yeah.
So we are definitely trying to foster that.
So I guess the point being is you have to say to your faculty when you're hiring them or when you're talking with them about their role is your job isn't just limited to lecturing,
right.
to giving tests. You've also got to be on some level an advocate for the students. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. We're really pushing hard this idea of student engagement outside the classroom. And so maybe the student is working with you in your research lab, in your biology lab, as you said, and you sense that something's not right in their life. Now, you may not feel equipped to handle that yourself, but we have people who've been trained to deal with all these kinds of problems.
President, one of the things you've talked about in the past is sort of changing the conversation. What's the conversation that you want to be going on the campus of the University of Utah? What should people be talking about? You said you want to sort of open it up. You want there to be a kind of a transparency, as I understand
we
it?
Do.
Anyway?
We do. We are talking a lot about the importance of focusing on students. My slogan with apologies to Ford Motor Company is that students are job one. We really want the faculty and the staff, in many cases the staff are just as critical to us as the faculty, focusing on the students. Today, our students are paying more of the cost of their education than the state. So we need to be very responsive to them, not only from financial reasons, but because that's the right thing to do. And so we are trying to emphasize the students. And this is just one of those things that we want to make sure the students have a good experience at the University of Utah.
Let me ask you this finally. Do you think, there's some sense, and some are frankly worried about it, that with schools taking on more of the responsibility for this issue, that it's going to change the quality of education or it's going to change the dynamic of the university? Is that something you worry about at all?
No, I don't worry about that because we are committed to the students. This is just part of being committed to the students.
David Pershing. He is, of course, the president of the University of Utah. We should mention in December, the University of Utah is hosting a seminar covering the law that regulates the reporting and defines victims' basic rights. There are details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Pershing, thanks very much for being with
us. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're wrapping up a series on sexual assault in college campuses. We've talked about in the past several weeks university culture, about the role of binge drinking. Today, we're moving beyond the matter of prevention to the issues of responsibility after an assault. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us on the program, again, is Robin Wilson, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's written about this issue. Her articles on sexual assault include Why Colleges Are on the Hook for Sexual Assault. She's joining us today from her office. And Robin Wilson, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me again.
I want to start with, because I wanted to ask you about this. So the use of Title IX. Title IX is now being interpreted to require colleges to investigate and resolve reports of sexual assault, rape, those kinds of things. Here's one of the questions you've asked in your reporting. How did a law, which was originally supposed to prevent gender discrimination, how did that morph into one that's being used to combat sexual assault? How did we get here at that point?
That law guarantees equal access to education for people. And if, for example, young women aren't getting access to education because they're suffering sex assaults, then they can claim violation under Title IX. And that's how it's now being used. And it's true that it's morphed over time and that there were several test cases of that really over the last couple of decades in courts that looked at elementary and secondary schools as well as colleges before we got to the point now where colleges are now regularly using Title IX to, if you want to say, prosecute or address these cases of assault.
You write about how it was in 2011 that the Department of Education, the Civil Rights Office there, really started to take this seriously, and they issued what's come to be known as a Dear Colleague letter, which seems to have been a big deal. It's kind of a turning point in some way. Would you talk about that?
Yes, that letter, I think, set out the standards that maybe existed previously, but kind of reminded colleges that, hey, we're going to be watching for this. And it set out a preponderance of the evidence standard, which seems to be the most significant thing, which is that unlike in a court of law where you need a greater standard of evidence for guilt, preponderance means literally 51% likely that this happened. And so that's the standard that colleges use in cases on campus when they're adjudicating cases of sexual assault. And if you talk to lawyers who represent mostly they're young men who are accused in these cases, they think that that is actually by definition unfair to those who are accused, and allows for less due process and allows really more young men to be found responsible than certainly would otherwise be in a court of law where the standard guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, is much higher. Mm-hmm. And so that was the main thing that letter did. But what it also did, besides that specific standard, is that it put colleges on notice and kind of made them stand at attention to tell them, we as the federal government are going to be looking to you, campuses, to handle these reports of sex assault. And we're going to be watching and we're going to be looking at what alleged victims tell us about how you handle these cases. And in fact, now there are investigations going on at the U.S. Education Department of complaints by alleged victims saying that colleges mishandled these, their reports of assault. And so it's really caused I don't know if you want to say an uproar, but really significant concern on the part of campuses that they have to get their acts together now to be responsible for hearing these cases.
We'll get back to the burden of proof question in a moment here, but what it seems as though is happening is that colleges now are being expected to develop a kind of court system. The question is, do they have the infrastructure for that? Let's set aside the question of burden of proof for a moment. Do they have the capacity to do that? Dr. David Pershing, the president of the University of Utah, said, yeah, we've got these systems in place, we've got these legal processes in place, but you also have a criminal justice system that's in place with another burden of proof. I mean, you've got these two systems playing out. How does that look? What's the give and take on all of that, the advantages and the disadvantages of having to adjudicate something as complicated like as this on a college campus?
That's clearly what campuses are struggling with, or a big part of what they're struggling with. But they've had systems in place, which the president was probably referring to, you know, for a long time to adjudicate all kinds of cases of student misconduct. And so they're using these same systems. The problem is that the requirements for looking at, and if you want to call it trying, a case of sex assault really are much greater than trying a case of, you know, someone who steals somebody's laptop, or maybe even a plagiarism case. And so they're stretching the limits and pushing the limits of these disciplinary and judicial systems that campuses have had in place for a long time already to look at student misbehavior. But now campuses are the places that are having to deal with these sex assaults. And so they're really scrambling and kind of going by their seat of their pants and making changes really as we speak now in terms of how to staff the adjudicatory panels, the panels that look at these things. Mm-hmm. In the past, a lot of these panels have been staffed with faculty members and even some students. But that can pose problems, campuses are finding out, because it's difficult to give people training on an issue like sexual assault and what constitutes an assault and how you figure that out. And so in some cases, campuses are really moving toward more of an outside investigator or a professional investigator that faculty members and students hear disciplinary cases. So really, it's a moving target right now in terms of how campuses are staffing themselves, and they're all sharing best practices and trying to get a handle on how they can best do this. They still haven't figured it all out yet.
So are there any voices within the federal government? You know, this came down as a sort of a mandate by the Department of Education. But are there any voices saying this isn't the role for universities or for campuses? That these systems need to be let's let them play out in the civil court system, or let's let them play out in the criminal court system. That universities ought not to be burdened with the legal liabilities of trying to do this.
There don't seem to me many voices on that side, I'll tell you the truth. I think that it's hard for anyone to say campuses shouldn't be dealing with this issue when you've got victims and victim advocacy groups that so strongly feel that they've been ignored by campuses, but also by the judicial system. If you are a young woman who experiences some type of sex assault on a campus, and you could call it maybe a date rape, if you go to local police and you attempt to get it handled or dealt with through the judicial system, chances are you will not find a prosecutor to do so. Mm-hmm. This is not like, if you want to call it stranger rape, yeah, where someone you don't know jumps out of the bushes, you know, and with a knife. These are two students, many times, who know each other, who've known each other, who maybe are in the same friend group, who could have had a relationship before, who may have even had sex before, and yet then an assault occurs, or an alleged assault occurs, and it's often so difficult for campus panels or for anyone to decide what happened, it becomes a she said this and he said this, that it's something that experience has shown, at least so far, is not something that the judicial system is willing to take on. And so in some ways, that's also a big reason that campuses have been left with this and have been put now at the forefront of having to deal with this.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call from Tom, who's with us in Wendover, Nevada. Tom, welcome.
Yeah, I got a different take on that. Having the colleges adjudicate these accuser situations puts them near an impossible situation when the accuser is like the Heisman Trophy winner last year, or a high-profile athlete, or the son of a big alumni donor. You know, the coaches will move heaven and earth to try to squash the allegation. The university will have millions of dollars on the line, depending on whether they can win this bowl game or go on to the national championship. And it seems like they would have a vested interest to protect the accuser, something that the regular judicial system will not have. If you look at the case of Jamias Wilson, I mean, they pretty much, the state of Florida moved heaven and earth to get him out of his trouble when he was accused of sexual assault.
It's a very good question. Robin Wilson, what do you think? That's another extenuating circumstance that universities have to deal with, the pressures of not just athletics, but any sort of high-profile, I guess, members of their faculty or their students.
I think the caller's exactly right, and a lot of people who are questioning the process and how fair it can be are saying that, which is that in any case, the university has a vested interest and possibly a conflict of interest in addressing and prosecuting any of these cases, because the fallout from them can affect the institution in any number of ways. And I believe that victims felt that that was one reason their cases were brushed off earlier, because a campus did not want to be seen as a place where an assault had occurred, and that it could be a reason now in the case of high-profile, possibly accused students, athletes, that an institution also has to think of its own interest. The institution, just like any other institution, necessarily has to do that. And so that comes into the mix. And while campuses, you'll have a hard time getting them to address that or getting them to acknowledge that, you know, it's common sense that that's going to happen. And I think people believe that that is a key problem with giving campuses this responsibility.
Tom, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Chris is with us in Salt Lake. Chris, welcome.
Hi there, Doug. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I teach at Westminster College, and I'm only speaking as a faculty member, not a member of the administration. But this topic has been very much discussed lately. Literally, we just had a training last Friday on Title IX.
Yeah.
And I guess one thing I feel maybe isn't entering into the conversation is that while certainly we wish for survivors of sexual assaults to go to the authorities, that's their decision, and that at the end of the day, whether or not perpetrators continue to take classes is the university's decision. So we need to stay involved in the process so that survivors aren't constantly being, you know, confronted with people that victimize them, right? So I just want to add that side to the equation, that however much the police are involved, they can't determine whether or not, you know, people go to classes.
Robin Wilson, that does complicate things.
Well, I think that the professor is right, and what he's saying is that there's a distinction between what, say, a criminal court system could do to someone who's been accused versus what a campus can do, and that the campus can also only do what's within its jurisdiction to someone who's been accused and found responsible. And so it's the campus's job, regardless of whether the court system takes this up, to decide on its campus who it will allow to be there and what a punishment will be for misconduct, whether it's sexual misconduct or other misconduct. And for example, if a campus finds a student responsible for sex assault, really the most the campus can do is expel the person. And so they are not in the business of levying any criminal penalties. That's not what campuses do. But they do see it their job in all sorts of circumstances to look at misconduct. And now sexual misconduct is a big thing they're looking at. And there is a distinction between the court system and then what the campus is hoping to accomplish.
You know, Chris, thanks very much, by the way. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Here's an email which raises another question that that Robin Wilson, you had mentioned earlier. This comes from someone who wants to be anonymous, for I guess it'll become apparent why. This person writes, I was wrongly accused of sexual assault by an old girlfriend many years ago. This hurt my reputation. It had profound negative effect on that period of my life. What this person wants to know is what the university is doing, and maybe I'll broaden it and ask what universities in general are doing to protect the rights of the accused, because this is something that you've written about, Robin Wilson, that you have an adjudicating system that's where they're adjudicating this on the campus is, as you point out in your articles, that it can be more appealing to a victim. There's a lower burden of proof. There's a less public process. There's a greater chance of actually doing something that protects them and calling into account the accused. But if you've got a lower burden of proof, and this is a dicey question, I know, but what are the implications for the accused? Would you talk about that part, if you would?
I believe that campuses think that, like in any other disciplinary process, they are about looking at the rights of the accused just as they are about looking at the rights of the victim. However, if you listen to them and how they are now scrambling to address the issue because of the Dear Colleague letter from the U.S. Education Department and its Office of Civil Rights that you mentioned, that there seems to be still some misunderstanding on campuses as to what that letter means their responsibility is. And I was at a conference once where someone asked the head of the Office for Civil Rights, should we err on the side of the victim now? Is that what that means? And I think a fair number of campuses believe they're being pushed in that direction, that if at all possible, they should find in favor of the victim and against the accused student. And that's exactly what the questioner was saying. And the woman who heads the Office of Civil Rights said, I'm sorry if we've given that impression. No, we want you to be fair. But clearly that question showed what's on the minds of campus officials and where they think that they're being asked to go with this. And so as a result, you are also getting young men and their lawyers now who are saying that the process is tilted against them, you know, just by virtue of colleges being pushed to deal with this. And some lawyers, 20 of them, recently actually wrote to the U.S. Congress and those that are sponsors of something called the Campus Accountability and Safety Act and said there are many things, even with the bill that you're proposing here, that really take away from the due process rights of those who've been accused. The bill refers to victims 34 times and to the accused only once. And they lay out a series of reasons how the bill doesn't allow for protection for the accused students, that in their rush to handle these cases and support victims, now campuses are almost going in what people would say sort of the opposite direction of maybe a few years ago, where victims said they weren't being heard. And now it's the accused who feel that very quickly they can be accused, found responsible, and expelled.
Let me ask you this finally. One of the people you talked to in the course of your reporting, a person by the name of Peter Lake at Stetson University, said that the issue is evolving as public opinion and public awareness evolves. This Mr. Lake said that society is redefining this issue. Is that sort of where we are, with the sort of give and take that's going on about the legal questions involved, about the sort of more social awareness involved? And we're still really maybe in early days in terms of how we're going to confront and deal with all of this.
Yes, so Professor Lake and other people like to sort of liken this whole situation to drunk driving laws before MAD, mm-hmm. way back when it was kind of a joke to tell your friends that you'd driven after you drank too much. And now, decades later, there's a no-tolerance policy for it. And they talk about sex assault as being in the early days of that, of evolution as well, in terms of how people even think about it, and whether it's assault or whether it's oops, a bad sexual encounter, and the seriousness of it and the penalties for it are really something that people are only beginning to think are as serious as people like Mr. Lake would like to see it taken. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely evolving, both in the way that the country and that students and people think about sex assault on campus, and also in the ways that campuses are addressing the issue. It's all really still evolving.
That's journalist Robin Wilson, who writes for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We'll put some links to her articles on our website. The ones you should look at right away are Why Colleges Are on the Hook for Sexual Assault, and also the article called Presumed Guilty. It's on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Robin Wilson, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
We'll take another break. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are wrapping up our series about sexual assault on college campuses. We've talked about university culture. We've talked about the role of binge drinking, for example. Now we're talking about this question of responsibility, the responsibility of the university after an assault takes place. Melissa Flores is with us, general counsel for Westminster College. Last month, she helped organize the college's symposium on sexual violence in Title IX. And Melissa Flores, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is a fraught issue, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, it's hard. It's so interesting. When we were putting together the show about alcohol and all of these, there people feel really uneasy about it. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to get your sense of why. I mean, there's sort of legal liability questions, but also I imagine it's because it's so complicated.
Absolutely. I will say that just before we get on this whole discussion about how we're campuses are scrambling to try to figure out how to deal with this, I wanted to mention that a lot of these systems have been in place. A lot of the things that we're talking about, I mean, Cleary, this is from 1992.
Say what Cleary is.
I'm sorry. Cleary is the law that requires colleges to actually report crime statistics on and around their campuses. So that's been around since 1992. Yeah. You know, we've had Title IX since the 70s. We've had the Violence Against Women's Act. We've had these things. And so a lot of colleges have already had systems in place. There has been increased scrutiny on colleges and universities with respect to Title IX just in recent years because of the 2011 Dear Colleagues letter, but also because of other issues that are presenting themselves. I mean, you look at things like Penn State and you look at all these things that are bringing up problems on college campuses. I wanted to touch back just very quickly about something that you were mentioning before with another, with Robin Wilson.
Yeah.
Title IX has requirements and it talks about things that might not be considered sexual assault in terms of a criminal prosecution. So when we're talking about things like sexual misconduct, it is more than just an actual rape or an alleged rape. And so in a lot of ways, the school is the best place. The college is the best place to deal with this because these are things that may not touch and concern any state or federal law. And so especially in terms of potential for criminal prosecution. So it is important for schools to look at things like sexual discrimination, sexual harassment, those kinds of things. And so that's where you see a lot of that increased scrutiny in terms of policies.
So you're glad that this is playing out on campuses?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons why I'm the most excited about it, I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I love talking about these things, but one of the things I'm the most excited about is that when we start engaging this discussion, when we start talking with faculty members, when we start talking with students about this, when we start talking with staff, we start talking about all aspects of sexual misconduct. We're talking about those offhanded comments in classrooms where they're talking about, oh, you know, girls can't really do this, or girls shouldn't be able to do that, or you're so much prettier if you keep your mouth shut, and, you know, things like that, that really are there. They have no place on an American college campus. They don't. On any college campus. And so I like the fact that we're dealing with these issues, that we're talking about it, and that we're looking at ways that we can help support our students and help train our students who will then, I mean, we are in the habit of, and we're in the business of educating, right?
But what, you're in the business of educating. Are you in the business, and I have put this question to President Pershing before mm-hmm. also, are you in the business of dealing with all of the other dimensions of that? You know, counseling people on sexual assault, dealing with their personal issues. I mean, I guess that does, from your perspective, it's not just education. It is a more extensive kind
yes.
of role of, for a faculty person.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, now part of the issue and part of the reason why colleges are having a lot of, you know, heartache about and heartburn about how to deal with this is because we have different terms. If you're looking at Clery, for instance, you're looking at reporting, you're talking about a CSA, which is a campus security a person, an advisor, an authority.
Yeah.
And you're talking about that person who has that requirement to report. If you're looking at Title IX, you're talking about a responsible party. You know, so, and who is a responsible party? So there's different terminology. There are different ways to sort of, you have to sort of wade through all of that. But let me address it from two points. One
yeah.
from a faculty member. A faculty member, I know at Westminster, I cannot.
Let me point out Chris, who called earlier as a faculty
okay.
member,
mm-hmm.
Seemed pretty cool with the idea that the university was going to handle it on
yes.
campus.
And at Westminster College, we have faculty members who are so incredibly engaged with their students and who value those students and want to do whatever they can for those students. If a student came to a faculty member and said, I need to report something, I can't go to our lab anymore, let's say, because I have to deal with this gentleman. Or a gentleman comes in and says, I have to deal with this woman who is constantly asking me out, or someone who is doing things that are, you know, just intimidating or threatening to me, our faculty would say, okay, well, let's sit down and let's talk about this. Now, the law does require that we say things like, before you tell me what you're going to tell me, let me tell you about my requirement to report. If you're looking to report something that you would like to keep confidential, these are the places where you can go for that.
Because if once you tell me, I have to.
Absolutely. I have to report.
Yeah.
So the key is we as colleges need to educate our faculty. We need to educate our staff. We need to educate our students as to their rights and their responsibilities. And I think once we get our arms around that, I think a lot of the concern, a lot of the fear will sort of die down when they see it's not as if we're trying to create police states all over campuses.
But that does raise this question. So you have on one hand sexual harassment mm-hmm. at various levels, but then you do cross a line when you're talking about sexual violence, mm-hmm. when you're talking about actual assault, when you're talking about rape, or something that doesn't may not be technically rape, but still sexual assault. Mm. Do universities, does Westminster College, for example, have the infrastructure to deal with that, which is to say the investigation part of it, the adjudication part of it? You know, you have a burden of proof that you have to deal with. You have mm-hmm. to account for the rights of the person who's being accused. Are you sure you want to be in that part of this?
Well, if we look at it from the civil versus the criminal side, on the criminal side, when someone goes in and reports something like that, they've reported sexual assault or report sexual misconduct, the criminal justice system has discretion as to whether they're going to pick it up or not, right? They have the discretion as to whether they're going to investigate. Under Title IX, we do not have that discretion. We are required
yeah.
to do it. So in terms of, do we have the infrastructure?
So it's a moot point.
It's a moot point.
We have to deal with
we
it
We have
anyway.
To deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, do we have the infrastructure? I'm sure every college and every university in this whole country would say we need more money, we need more resources. Absolutely, we need that. But in terms of the basic infrastructure, we have the guidelines. We know that we need to provide certain things. We know that we have to address this issue from a policy perspective and from an education perspective. And because we know we have that, I think it makes it a little bit, I mean, like I said, it's a moot point of whether we're going to. It makes it a little bit easier to decide how we're going to do it.
Are you worried about the rights of the accused?
Absolutely. I'm a civil rights lawyer. Of course. Of course I am.
Is it, are college campuses now, who are still trying to figure all this out,
mm-hmm.
deferring more to victims than the accused, do you think? Is that fair to say?
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak to that on the national level. I can say that the Q&A, and I know that you haven't talked too much about the Q&A on the show today, but the Office of Civil Rights actually put out a question and answer, you know.
32 questions and answers, right?
About how to address these issues. And if you look through there, there's words that are just recurring: balanced, fair. You know, you're really looking for a process that is balanced and fair. If one person wants to bring an attorney, the other person can bring an attorney. If one person wants to provide character letters, the other person has to as well. I think that if you really understand and if you implement that fair and balanced approach, I think you are going to be really seeing it from you know, pulling back a little bit and seeing it from both sides.
Even now, if you lower the burden of proof, even if you say
the burden of proof has always been lower. I mean, you have had
that's another moot point. Then
yeah,
you say, okay.
You have had some schools who have maintained a higher standard, but the burden has always been more likely than not. We certainly can't impose a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt when we're looking at something that doesn't have that criminal side, that deprivation where someone could actually go to jail over it. So even with the more likely than not standard, that can actually tip in favor of either party.
Let me take your call.
Okay.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Lucy has been waiting. Lucy, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hello. I would ask about the fact that so many of these sexual assaults are from sexual predators. And are our universities capable of separating out, because it's not like 25% of women are raped by 25% of the men. There is subsection who are actual serial rapists. What better place for a sexual predator than a fraternity house? And are our universities equipped to separate out those people who are predators and not just simply guilty of sexual misconduct?
That's a good question.
That's a great question. And I really appreciate the Lucy's comment about how we're looking at predators. And if you look at the statistics, people who perpetrate these types of sexual misconduct, what we'll call sexual misconduct because I work in the school field and not in the criminal justice system, they are multiple offenders. I mean, these are serial offenders. It's not many, many guys or many, many women, involved in this. But I think that we don't take these complaints on an ad hoc basis. We look at it, if there's a person who has been accused more than one time, if there's a person who has whose name is surfacing as someone who is engaging in this type of behavior, then naturally almost all college campuses and universities around the country will have either their own security department, they'll have their own police force, or what the Office for Civil Rights is recommending, they'll have a memo of understanding with a local police agency so that they can discuss this, these things, and they can disseminate that information and put it where it needs to go. And I think that gives us a little bit more leverage in dealing with these cases if you have that memo of understanding with your local law enforcement.
It's interesting, in August, the Department of Education, they released a list of 76 colleges or universities that have pending Title IX sexual violence investigations. There weren't any Utah schools on that list. What does that tell you? Does that reflect something about that the state is doing something right, or that they've gotten lucky, or that there are other social or maybe cultural forces in play?
I think I would never say that all of our schools are doing everything right here in Utah. But I do think that it could be just because they haven't picked up one of our schools yet. They haven't picked up a complaint. It also could be there are cultural factors or social factors. I think we all of us look at this as not if, but when that complaint comes down from the Office for Civil Rights, and we're addressing it as such.
So what... I know you're not going to admit you've got a handle on this, but do you feel like you're figuring it out? I mean, do you feel good about sort of where you're headed in terms of the feedback that you're getting from faculty and from other universities? And by the way, are you commiserating with other universities?
Absolutely. We had 212 participants at our symposium, and we had people all the way from Southern Utah all the way up to Utah State, colleges, universities from all over the state coming in and learning together and talking together about this. And I do feel like we're getting a handle on it. Of course, we need more money. We need more resources. We need new
jobs.
What's
the hardest part? What's the hardest bit that you still really have, if you would be candid with me, what's the toughest thing that you haven't quite figured out yet, do you think, if there is such a thing?
I would say that the dissemination of the training is very difficult. It's very easy to say, we'll just hold a training session. But in terms of holding that training session, you know, time is very, very valuable. You've got people who are doing their full-time job. You've got people who are helping students. You've got students who are working and who are also going to school. So that's been the hardest part. Not wanting to do the training or knowing the training is important, but finding the places to put that training in place.
So do you feel like this was, I'll put this question to you, the same I did to Robin Wilson at the end of our interview, this idea that we're kind of in a new world, right? And as there becomes more social awareness, more public awareness, your response to it will probably evolve. So I guess you're seeing this as early days too, but you feel encouraged?
Absolutely. Absolutely feel encouraged. I think this is something that has been crying out for attention for many years. I'm excited that we're giving it the attention that it deserves. I'm very excited that at least at Westminster, we have a president who is very committed to really looking at these issues that are student issues, things that, I mean, that are very important to safety, to college safety, to their learning environment. So I do feel encouraged.
It's Melissa Flores. She's general counsel for Westminster College. Last month, she helped organize the college's symposium for sexual violence in Title IX. Melissa, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.